Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The Black Lives Matter movement has found support in corporate boardrooms and among CEOs who have pledged to help do something to change America's tenuous relationship with race. We're going to talk about that tomorrow on this program, but the embrace of that movement by corporations is an example of the mixture of politics and commerce. And on this Politics Monday, we have another example of that strange mixture that has stirred up a decent amount of controversy of late. It took place just a few weeks ago in the White House Rose Garden when the CEO of Goya Foods, Robert Unanue, said this.
We're all truly blessed at the same time to have a leader like President Trump, who is a builder. And that's what my grandfather did. He came to this country to build, to grow, to prosper. And so we have an incredible builder, and we pray. We pray for our leadership, our president, and we pray for our country that we will continue to prosper and to grow.
Unanue's remarks were intended to be celebratory, marking Trump's signing of an executive order pledging to improve Hispanic Americans' access to educational and economic opportunities. Instead, they fueled a backlash, targeting Unanue and Goya with calls to boycott the popular Hispanic-owned brand. Clips soon circulated on social media highlighting the president's often incendiary rhetoric and controversial policies aimed at minority communities and immigrants, and the reaction seemed to catch the CEO off guard. He defended himself on Fox News by decrying the boycott as, quote, suppression of speech, and questioning why his past praise of former President Obama went unchallenged, but his remarks about Trump prompted swift criticism. But in these hyperpartisan times, why would a corporate CEO want to become associated with any politician or political point of view? Where did the idea that this would be a good thing to do come from? Evidently, it's been going on forever. In fact, one of our guests today says consumer politics is as American as apple pie. And that guest is Dr. Lawrence Glickman, professor of history and American studies at Cornell University, and the author of Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in America. He joins us this morning from Ithaca, New York, where it's still relatively warm at the moment, right?
Yes, it is. Good morning.
Good morning. He's joined by Americus Reed. Dr. Reed is a professor of marketing at Donald Trump's alma mater, the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. Thank you for being here as well. Welcome.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome. So, Dr. Glickman, let me start with you because you have traced this intersection of politics and consumerism back to the Boston Tea Party. And you say that this rejection of British tea by the colonists was the start of a, quote, continuous series of consumer boycotts. Talk about that. Give us some other examples.
Yeah, well, one of the things I tried to show in my book is that there are a few famous boycotts we know about in American history, such as the Montgomery bus boycott of 1955-56. A lot of people know about the United Farm Workers grape boycotts of the 1970s and beyond. But what I wanted to show is that that this is, as I said, a nearly continuous American tradition, actually starting before the United States was formed with the Boston Tea Party of 1773. One of the things I wanted to show is that Americans have always connected consumption and politics in a wide variety of ways. And one of the examples I talk quite a lot in my book is the boycott of slave-made goods organized by abolitionists, especially by Quakers, and mostly in Philadelphia, but other parts of the country as well. I think it's really interesting that Americans have connected up consumption with citizenship, saying that when you buy goods or you don't buy goods, that's a political act. I think for a lot of Americans in the modern consumer society, we tend to, not to think of shopping as political. We think of that as something different. And so it's important to be reminded of that tradition. And then when things like the Goya boycott happens, it kind of jogs us back to, oh, yeah, these choices we make in the shopping aisle are political choices.
So if it started here in 1773 with the Boston Tea Party, did the colonists steal that idea from Europeans, or did they originate that idea with the Boston Tea Party?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, one of the things I look at in my book is the way in which boycotters sort of tried to create a historical tradition. And one of the things that boycotters connected it to was the idea that went all the way back to ancient Greece of ostracism. You know, you would cast people out of your community if they did something dishonorable. And they compared boycotting to that quite frequently. They said, what we're doing through commerce is really very not that dissimilar from what the ancient Greeks did. If someone had acted dishonorably, you would cast them out of your community. And we're doing that sort of metaphorically through the chains of commerce.
So, Dr. Reed, if you agree with Dr. Glickman, and I think you do, because I saw you nodding vigorously there as he was talking about the starts of these boycotts, since these have been a continuous series of boycotts over time, and as he said, Americans connect consumerism with politics, it's a political decision, why in God's name do we have instances of CEOs making political statements or associating themselves with politics or policies? I thought these guys were smart people. This seems to be awfully dumb to do.
Well, it's a great point. I do want to build on what Larry's talking about as well, because I think in the modern marketing world, we understand that we're looking for different ways to try to connect with consumers as services, organizations, products, and brands. And Larry's right. It's very much the case that when you reach for that product and you take it on, you're basically identity signaling, right? You're saying something about who you are because these brands presumably stand for something. And in the modern era of marketing, many of these brands try to tell a story about themselves that go beyond just what they do in terms of the functional features, the utilitarian types of benefits. And they try to speak to values because these brands, products, and services and organizations understand that if we can talk to a consumer in terms of values, we have an opportunity to deeply connect with them in ways that go beyond just the aesthetics of the product or the stuff, right? So in some sense, it's a smart strategy if it's executed well, because on the back end of that, what you get is deeply loyal consumers who are, they're with you now, not because they think, or not only because they think your product's good, but they're with you because they perceive an alignment of values with your company with their own. And that's a much, much harder bond to break if you're a competitor trying to steal away that customer. So in some sense, it's a very smart thing to do because it has a long-term benefit of creating what I refer to as identity loyalty, which is when the product really transcends what it does and becomes part of who you are. And so when the product becomes part of who you are, then you will basically defend the product more vigorously, more vehemently, because an attack on the product is essentially an attack on yourself. So just as Larry's saying, you know, there's in groups and out groups, and these products and brands can over time become associated with these different groups.
But it would seem to me that would only work with a certain segment of your buyer population. I mean, you can take a stand on something as a corporate CEO or as a corporation in general, and you might lose 40, 50, 60% of your customers because they don't agree with you. So are these companies that do take a stand, these CEOs that do take a stand, are they doing research to see how that might impact their pool of buyers?
That's a great question. And, you know, the answer is yes, I hope so. Because, I mean, if you look at some of the great examples, right, you look at a company like Ben & Jerry's, right? So for a long time, they've come out and really been very clear on what it is that they stand for in terms of some of the liberal values that are associated with what they want to build their brand around. They understand that. And they, so basically they're like essentially activists who happen to sell ice cream. But they understand that I'm going to lose some consumers who don't agree with me, but the net positive impact of gaining the ones who do is that I get this group that's going to be potentially much more fiercely loyal to what I'm doing than the people who I lost because I made a stance, as Larry was saying, and connecting my brand to something that has to do with political ideology.
But then you have these moments in time, like the one I referenced in the beginning with Mr. Unanue with Goya Foods, where he seemed to be taken off guard off kilter, off balance when the reaction to it came in. He obviously didn't do the research. And it seems to me he wouldn't have to do the research if you're selling an Hispanic brand.
Yes.
And you're going to associate with a president who has been pretty hard on Hispanic people.
That's correct. I mean, I think it's a good point. I mean, but it's in some levels, I mean, it's curious to me. I'm not sure why he did this, because it's not necessary to create a situation where you're going to try to create some kind of empirical horse race between the people who are going to boycott you versus the people who are going to boycott you. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not sure what the point is of that. I think he could have gone in and made a statement and supported the president, and been sort of, you know, respecting the White House as one might do. But I think when he came out and made this very strong statement of support publicly, it raised a lot of eyebrows, especially for people who are really upset about the fact that what they perceive as Donald Trump's policies that have been perceived as quite negative with respect to the Hispanic community.
So, Dr. Glickman, since you've traced this back through time for several hundred years, how impactful, how successful on average are these boycotts? Do they usually result in any kind of meaningful change, or do they usually fail?
Well, the short answer to that question is definitely the latter, which is that they usually failed. And this is something I wrestle with quite a lot in my book. Because one of the things, as a historian, we're always trying to look in the long term. And, you know, sometimes a particular movement might fail, but the message of that movement might succeed in the long term. So my argument is that looking at boycotts, discrete boycotts, from the point of view of did they win or did they lose, is probably not the best way to understand them. And I think the best example I can give of that is what I referred to earlier, which is this abolitionist campaign to boycott slave-made goods in the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, before the Civil War. Abolitionists set up these things called free produce stores starting in 1826. And these were supposed to compete with the stores that sold slave-made cotton and, you know, sold candy with sugar that was grown by enslaved people and so forth. These stores were almost all complete and total failures. They rarely lasted more than a year. But my argument is that what these stores did was they let especially Northern consumers know that they were connected to the system of slavery. They couldn't stand outside of that system, and that their shopping choices were endorsing slavery. I mean, one of the slogans of that movement was if there were no consumers of slave-made goods, there would be no slavery. So what they did was they took the onus off of you know, Southern slave owners, and they put it on Northern consumers. And so that movement didn't immediately succeed, but I think it did lead a lot of people to say, hey, no one can be separated from this evil system in this country. And so that's an example of something that I think in the long run contributed to the broader anti-slavery sentiment that ultimately led to the Civil War.
And Dr. Reed, we have less than a minute left in this segment, but you have said that does it work? Do these things work? It's a trick question. It depends on what you mean by work, you say. Yes. And you say that if a boycott reflects a movement rather than a moment, it could change the world.
That's correct. Seconds. Yeah, that's correct. And I think that it's really hard to keep these boycotts going because you need sustained energy. And in a 24-hour news cycle, it's just so difficult because consumers have so many other distractions and other things that they're worried about that really, you know, unless someone's, you know, pulls an unforced error and keeps this thing sort of in the news, it probably will just die out eventually on its own.
Plus, if you like Goya beans, you like Goya beans. We have to take a break. We're coming back with more in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about buying power, the history of boycotts, and do they work when they're associated with political causes or politicians. Lawrence Glickman, is professor of history and American studies at Cornell University and the author of Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in America. And Americus Reed is professor of marketing at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Glickman, you say that you have a theory of which types of boycotts work. Talk about that.
I would say two very different types of boycotts tend to succeed. And one is a very local kind of boycott. If your clientele surrounds a workplace that has done something controversial, those can often work. A lot of the so-called labor boycotts of the 1880s occurred in working class neighborhoods. And if a bakery or a brewery, say, didn't hire union workers or paid workers low wages, and a boycott was organized, those would often succeed because the clients of that bakery or that brewery lived in the neighborhood. They tended to be working class, and they tended to extend solidarity in that way. It's a lot harder to do that at the national level, however, because you have consumers entering the picture for all sorts of reasons. But at the national or even international level, I think the kind that work are not necessarily going to be economic in nature, but political in nature. They're going to raise political consciousness about an issue. And I think a good example of that would be the United Farm Workers Great Boycott, which really led a lot of Americans to be aware of the really, you know, awful conditions in agriculture, mostly in California, that migrant farm workers were experiencing and so forth. A lot of Americans participated in those boycotts. I wouldn't necessarily say they won the day economically, but I think they did make this issue a national hot button issue. And I think there are so many other boycotts we can think of that have worked at that level, maybe not economically impacted the company, but raised an issue that we now, you know, there's more consciousness about as a whole.
I want to go back to something, Dr. Reed, that you were talking about in the last segment for a moment, and that was the role that self-concepts play in making buying decisions. In other words, consumers often buy or don't buy products because of how they view themselves, and they want to be true to themselves. Politics and political points of view would seem to be among the strongest self-identifiers. You are either a Democrat or a Republican, you're a conservative, you're a liberal, you like Trump or you don't like Trump. So given that, would companies be wise to either steer clear of politics and policy altogether or embrace the Ben and Jerry's model and say, this is what we are, this is what we stand for. If you agree, you're one of us, come buy our ice cream.
Yeah, I have a pretty strong view on this, Mike, and I want to pull it back into what Larry's talking about, too. It's like when he was talking about local, you're talking about deeply connected things that are close and tightly affiliated with the person. And so when you make that decision as a company, you're making a bit of a moral decision and an economic decision. It's like at the CEO top level, I'm deciding like this is what's important and this is what I stand for. And I'm making that decision realizing as a savvy marketer that I'm going to attract people who I want to attract that I think are going to be loyal, and I'm going to live with that. So when Nike came out and said, you know, we're going to be behind Colin Kaepernick and these protests, they were making a bold statement, but they understood that from a demographic perspective that they were attracting for this type of argument a certain type of customer, and they were perfectly okay with not attracting those who would not align themselves with that value. And it's so, I mean, in some sense, it's just marketing, because marketing by definition is talking to a segment and not necessarily trying to talk to everybody. So you're hoping that that segment is going to be loyal and will stay with you. And one way to do that is to connect on political identity, which is very, very powerful. I mean, in the 2016 election, you could see the correlation between whether or not the Democrat or the Republican candidate won based on the concentration of either Whole Foods markets or Cracker Barrels in the environment. So, I mean, this is clearly a powerful identity. And I think it's a smart decision. If you understand your customer and who they are, then you're just simply saying that I'm going to really lean in on my ability to try to create alignment with their self-concept, their identity, and their desire to self-express and be in this tent with me.
So it's also a way to tell consumers who you are. It's a way to carve out your niche in the marketplace.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Can I just add that I think Nike is a really, really interesting example, because I think they're a good example of a brand that sells shoes and other athletic stuff, but really sells a lifestyle, as Americus is saying. You know, it is interesting because, you know, Nike ran into trouble in the late 90s, early 2000s because of their reliance on sweatshop labor. And there was also the example, the famous, possibly apocryphal example of Michael Jordan saying that, you know, Republicans buy sneakers too, so I don't want to, you know, get involved in the Harvey Gantt race and, you know, and this sort of thing. So it is interesting the way in which when a company does establish that brand, they could be accused of hypocrisy if they're seen as violating that spirit.
Well, Michael Jordan, it wasn't the CEO of Nike. He was just one of their key spokespeople and a very influential person among those who would buy anybody's sneakers, much less a Nike's. And I suppose it makes a difference if you are Jeff Bezos and you own both Amazon and the Washington Post and you're the billionaire owner, you can make a unilateral decision. But if you're just a CEO, you work the pleasure of the board of directors. So when you make a decision to support a cause or to not support a cause or to support a politician, should you be getting the input of the board? Should you muzzle yourself if they aren't on the same page, Americus?
Well, I think you should be getting as much information as you can. It's about business intelligence. You should have a sense of what is going to be the impact if I lean in on this. I think that going back to a previous example, when Chick-fil-A, S. Truett Cathy came out with the statements about the definition of marriage should be between a man and a woman, suddenly Chick-fil-A was in the hot spot, if you will, because now we're looking at a very upset LGBTQ community who's saying, like, what does this happen? You know, why this is terrible? And we saw boycotts and boycotts. But it was interesting because if you look at Chick-fil-A, they are a fantastically successful company. They're not open on Sunday, so they're giving up their Sunday sales. 52 days of sales a year they're giving up because they want to profess these strong Christian values. But at the same time, at some point, the decision was made that, you know, we take a look at what's going on here, and there's a lot of money left on the table if we just completely ignore this LGBTQ community. And quite honestly, it doesn't really have anything to do with definition of marriage. Doesn't really have anything to do with our chicken, really. And we want to keep selling the chicken. So they pulled back and really kind of walked back. They didn't give up those values, but they walked back and said, you know, we're going to stay out of this political conversation. And so sometimes it makes sense to not be involved in it. Other times, as Larry's saying, it's just going to be part of the C-suite's leadership. Like, this is who I am at the top, and I'm going to live with this decision, and I'm going to be okay with it. So I think, you know, brands and values are going to continue to be important. And I think even in a pandemic, what I've noticed is that people are by themselves self-quarantined, thinking about what's important to me. So brands better come out and say, hey, here's a reason why you should continue to support me when this pandemic is over. And one way to do that is to like Larry's saying, focus in on political ideology and other types of values.
A recent report from Advertising Week called the 2020 Survival Guide for Brands found that although 15% of consumers have increased their shopping with a brand that's taken a political stance, 29% have stopped buying from that brand. So one-fifth have implored family or friends to stop supporting that brand. 16% have posted on social media about the brand, and about the same percentage have signed petitions against the company. And it is educated, liberal, and wealthy consumers who are most likely to boycott, according to Advertising Week. Dr. Glickman, how should brands view and use that information?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, so much of this, I think, is guesswork, and it's really sometimes hard to determine what the impact is. And, to me, the key is getting back to, I think, the point that Americus has been making about the importance of establishing a brand outside of whatever it is that you sell. I think that's so important in the modern world and the modern economy, because I do think consumers, it's not necessarily always a strictly political decision, but I think America's is right that it has to do with the identity that people want. And a lot of Nike's advertising wasn't really about politics. It was about, are you the kind of person who's going to just do it? Are you going to be the kind of person who's going to, you know, extend yourself to the limits? And of course, a lot of us want to think whether we are or not, we want to feel we're that way. So I think it is a tricky business for companies to navigate, because those issues are so important.
Easier for some companies, I would think, than others, because the same study reports that young people, Gen Zers and millennials, want corporations to use their influence to affect political and cultural change. Older people do not. So America's Read, if you're Cadillac or you are Mercedes, should you steer clear or take positions that would favor an older political point of view? And if you're Lululemon or Nike, you go with somebody who's younger? Is that what you do?
Well, I think it's a short-term and long-term strategy. I think in some sense, if you know who your customer is and who you're trying to attract, that's going to help guide the answer to that. So one thing you have to keep in mind, though, Mike, is that, and this, I'm not saying this to be grotesque, but older consumers will eventually die. So at some point, you're going to have to talk to a younger consumer. And just like Larry's saying, these younger consumers, they have a kind of different perspective. They want to know, what do you stand for? How are you treating the environment? How do you treat your labor, your workers? All of these things matter to them, because at the end of the day, you might have two products, Mike, that are almost the same on all their ability to deliver on features. And the tipping balance might just be that, well, this one other product is just more like me. I just feel like emotionally I can connect with it on my values. And that might be the difference in buying versus not buying. So it's very powerful.
Is that what's at work here in the Black Lives Matter movement? We have companies like Nike and Twitter and Netflix and Citigroup who quickly aligned themselves with that movement. Have they determined that that is where their bread is buttered, with supporters of that movement? Or is it more of a moral decision or the desire to be on the right side of history, Dr. Reed?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both, right? It's hard to disentangle what's the decision calculus. Is it moral or is it economic? I think in some senses, we're in a moment right now where, I mean, you look at companies, they're not able to sort of stand on the sidelines anymore and kind of give a wishy-washy answer if they're asked about George Floyd or other kinds of issues around social justice. I think right now it's like the companies have to take a stand and just live with what that stand is. You look at, you know, companies that are changing their packaging. Aunt Jemima went away recently because of the negative stereotyping perceptions of the brand and the product and all these kinds of things. Washington Redskins just changed the name of their entire football team to the Washington Football Team. I mean, this is tremendous change that you're seeing now. It's a massive flashpoint in time. And Larry can speak to this because he's the guru and the historian on this aspect. But I've never seen anything like this in terms of there's so much powerful salience around the movement and how Black Lives Matters has really kind of met that intersection.
This change happened without a boycott, Dr. Glickman. I mean, this happened just because companies thought, this is a movement and we got to get on the right side of that movement. And we need to do it fast.
Yeah, it is interesting. You know, I think boycott is one manifestation of politics, but there are other manifestations, and seeing millions of people in the streets demonstrating, and also, you know, public opinion polls showing that despite what, you know, Donald Trump and others thought might happen, that the movement for Black Lives is very popular. And, you know, surveys are showing that most Americans support it. I don't think companies are acting cynically, but I do think that, you know, they did want to be seen as standing for these humane values. I think many of them have done that, not necessarily because of fear of setting off a boycott, but because they wanted to be positioned for what they took the modern world to be. Mm.
When a company or a CEO takes a stand on a moral issue or an ethical issue, how fine a line are they walking? I mean, do they have to really make sure that if they are held accountable, it will be discovered that they are not only talking the talk, but they're walking the walk, Dr. Reed?
That's 100% correct. I think that, you know, consumers are smart and they understand a few things. One is they're going to look at your footprint over time and see, like, what have you been doing before all of this hit? And are you a Johnny come lately? Or have you been like investing in these kinds of social justice issues over time? That's number one. And then number two, moving forward, once you take that stand, to build on what Larry's saying, it's all about authenticity, right? What do I do? It's not enough to just simply black out your social media and say, okay, hashtag you know, Black Lives Matter. We want to know, what are you doing? Are you donating to causes? Are you raising awareness? Are you creating movements? Are you creating initiatives in your company? Are you going into the community and helping the community address the issues that are really behind some of the challenges that create a George Floyd situation? And so, you know, all of this stuff is going to be basically available to consumers, and they can find it out very easily because of that fantastic thing called the Google machine. and you know, they're going to be able to find out whether or not you're just giving window dressing or actually serious about doing something about the issue.
In the aftermath of the Parkland, Florida shootings at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Dr. Glickman, you wrote about, quote, the coordinated economic attacks on the National Rifle Association from credit card companies and delivery services, insurers, car rental companies, airlines, and others. And at the time, I remember this, it seemed as though this was going to have a crippling effect on the NRA, and it was going to maybe change America's love affair with guns. Well, the NRA is still with us, and we still have plenty of guns to go around. So was all that for naught?
You know, I don't think so. Again, as a historian, I take the long-term perspective. And, you know, an organization like the NRA had acquired massive political power, and it still has a lot of political power. But, you know, I would say that its reputation has been dinged a little bit by this, and that who knows what the future will hold. But I think we may look back in 50 years and say Parkland was a turning point. It's too early to say. That's one of historians' favorite sayings.
So is it, when you look back on the history of boycotts or the how boycotts may have impacted a particular cause or moral position, is it usually death by a thousand cuts over time, or is it, there's the boycott, there's the change?
Definitely usually the death by a thousand cuts, I would say. It's really rare, as I was saying, that a boycott just works, and that's the end of the story. It's usually, you know, boycotts are part of broader political campaigns and so forth, and so it's just one element of many.
We're talking about the impact of boycotts on politics and politicians, and whether they work and how they work and why they would work or why they don't often work, because they don't often work, with Lawrence Glickman, who is a professor of history and American studies at Cornell University and the author of Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in America. He's with us from Ithaca, and America's Reed is with us from Philadelphia, where he's a professor of marketing at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. We have more to talk about. We'll do it in just a moment at Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with Dr. Lawrence Glickman from Cornell University and Dr. America's Reed from the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School of Business about boycotts and their impact on products and politics and consumers. Dr. Reed, you said that brands are part of who we are. So does that make it even more difficult for boycotts to succeed? Because some of us are, you would have to pry Apple products from the cold, dead fingers of a lot of people, even if they disagree with the political stance that company took, because they just love the products. So right. Does it make it that much harder for the boycotts of certain companies to succeed?
Well, I want to go back to what Larry's saying. I mean, you have to look at what success means, right? So in some senses, you know, awareness of a situation, awareness of a big issue is an important aspect. You know, typically you're not going to put that company out of business, right? So in some senses, it's about mental change or the mental model about how we approach some of these issues. But I think I agree with what you're saying, Mike. I think it's a double-edged sword. I think once you create a kind of connection with a person's sense of who they are and identity, they become fiercely loyal. They become a one man, one woman walking marketing department for free. And so they become this kind of word of mouth advocate, this soldier out there in the field, so to speak, defending and seeing. But see, what's interesting about this is, like, go back to the original Goya example, right? So if you have the people who boycott Goya versus the people who boycott, then you think about, like, why the people who are buying to protect these comments. Are they really into the product? Do they even know what Goya is? Or are they just going out there and supporting this to sort of, like, keep this thing, you know, level in a sort of a horse race sort of sense? But my argument is that the people who are deeply loyal to you, they have a lot of power with respect to what they can do with in terms of bringing positive awareness to your brand. And so you just want to be very, very careful, and you want to sort of start from the starting point of, I really understand who my customer is, and you can avoid some of the challenges and problems that you, that are just really unforced errors, the way I look at it, in terms of when these things get out of control.
So we mentioned earlier that it is educated, liberal, wealthy consumers who are most likely to engage in boycotts. Before the announcement by consumers of their intent to boycott Goya products, President Trump had accused the, quote, radical left of using these moves to hurt their enemy. Dr. Glickman, would you say there's truth to that?
I wouldn't, you know, I think I disagree a little bit, because one of the points I try to make in my book is that the boycott can be used for any political purpose. And if you look at history, it's often been used for conservative purposes. And, you know, I mentioned before the boycott of slave made goods, but there was also a, you know, Confederate boycott of goods from the Union. So oftentimes boycotts take many political forms. And I was just thinking in this just brief discussion before about the Southern Baptist Convention boycott of companies like Disney and Ford and Microsoft in the 1990s for their gay-friendly policies at a time when that seemed like a real cultural flashpoint. The fact is, most of their, you know, most customers ignored those boycotts, but they were called as political efforts to stop and punish companies for acting in ways that they disagreed with. So I think it is true that most of the most prominent and famous boycotts in American history have been probably on the progressive side, but certainly not the only ones.
And are there, can you tell if the progressive boycotts are any more effective than the conservative boycotts or vice versa?
That's a great question. I don't think, partly because determining victories is so difficult, I'm not sure you could say that. Although I guess, you know, some of the signature successful boycotts have been on the progressive side, you know, the Montgomery bus boycott, the United Farm Workers boycott. I'm not sure how you would characterize the Boston Tea Party, but there is an example of a kind of consumer activism that also won.
The Goya boycott is just the latest example of a boycott taking place during the Trump presidency. There have been others. Home Depot was threatened last year when the co-founder evidently pledged to donate to the president's re-election campaign. A company called SoulCycle and Equinox, or Equinox, came under pressure because they were backed by a billionaire developer who hosted campaign fundraisers for the president. Hobby Lobby, Papa John's, L.L. Bean, and Bank of America found themselves briefly in the spotlight because of their intersection in some way or another with Donald Trump. Does this happen in every administration, Dr. Reed?
That's a great question. I'm going to, you know, punt that over to Larry because he's a historian on this.
Does it?
I would say yes. ever since, you know, I completed my book in 2009 and, you know, thinking I was writing about history, but it was amazing how many boycotts followed that moment. And I was on radio shows like this constantly for 2 or 3 years. Most of them, we've forgotten many of these boycotts, the Whole Foods boycott, for example, and other boycotts that, you know, were in the headlines for a period of weeks or months and then forgotten. There was a boycott of the state of Arizona for its draconian immigration laws, you know, lots and lots of boycotts. I can barely remember all of them. But I would say I think they have picked up the pace, and partly because we're living in such polarized times today. So I think in the Trump administration, they probably have been more front and center, but I don't think it's unusual.
Well, let's turn this around for a second, because Donald Trump himself has called for boycotts against companies like Nike, CNN, and Apple. You're the historian, Dr. Glickman. Is that a presidential first? Has it ever happened before that a president would call for a boycott of a company?
I can't think of a president engaging in that way. The only parallel I could think of is that in the 1930s, there was a boycott organized of Japanese silk. The idea was that Americans are big consumers of Japanese silk, and Japan has a fascist government. They've invaded China and so forth. And President Roosevelt ultimately came around and supported an embargo of that. But that wasn't about a company. It certainly wasn't about, it wasn't a punishing an American company directly. So I can't think of a parallel.
Have his calls for boycotting companies like Apple and CNN had any impact whatsoever?
Well, the one thing I would say is I remember there was a boycott of Keurig. I can't remember why now, but I remember all these Trump.
Because it doesn't make good coffee. That's why.
Oh, probably because of the environmental impact of the cups.
Okay.
Well, I don't remember the details, but I remember people were posting videos of them destroying their Keurig machine, just as they posted videos of them burning their Nike sneakers and their Nike logos and so forth, which I thought was a very interesting political statement to make, that, you know, using modern social media, and Americus can maybe speak to this, but I think it's fascinating the way in which it intersects with that.
Since so many people have engaged in boycotts, because I think 50% of Americans say they have boycotted businesses at some point in their life. This is according to YouGov. I don't know what that is, but it's an organization called YouGov. And those with household incomes over $80,000 a year are especially likely to have boycotted a business in protest. What does that tell you, Dr. Reed?
Well, it tells me that Maslow was pretty smart when he came up with the hierarchy of needs. I mean, the idea is that, you satisfy lower order needs before you satisfy higher order needs. And so you got to feed yourself and have shelter first. And then after that, you'll think about self-actualization, other kinds of things that relate to, you know, these issues of being interested in trying to be involved in movements and those kinds of things that have to do with identity expression and stuff like that. So it doesn't surprise me that, if you have money, you have times and availability and ability to actually, participate in a boycott. I think what's interesting about it is, though, that, again, the idea that if you're a smart company, because Nike didn't budge on what they were doing, even as Larry was saying, that, you know, people are posting videos of the shoes getting burned. And it's like Nike said, well, we understand that, but we still understand who our customer is and who our customer is going to be in the future. Hmm. And so they understood that very clearly and calmly, and we're making a bet on that. And so I think it's an important kind of thing. If you're a smart business decision maker, you understand who your customer is and you understand where they're going in terms of the future.
Consumers boycott for other reasons, other than political reasons, moral reasons, ethical reasons, a myriad of reasons. Given that, are they just a part of doing business? Do they get factored into a company's calculation of how they might do in this next quarter?
I think so. I think almost all smart companies, Mike, have some kind of plan about a brand crisis should it befall their company. And so they hopefully have thought about this and they've put into place kind of how they're going to handle things that happen in this way. What I'm more concerned about is more the unforced error. Like why would you jump into this? You don't, you're doing really well. If you're Goya, you have a strong connection with the Hispanic community. Like, why would you create a situation where now I have to hope that the boycotts outlive the boycotts? And I know that, like Larry's saying, you know, consumer vigilantism is hot now because everyone's walking around with a cell phone in their pocket and they can immediately put your company on the internet and have it go around the world five times before the CEO wakes up. So it's like we're in a moment now where all of these things has a certain kind of urgency to it. So you got to be smart and kind of understand who your customer is if you're going to try to get involved in any of these kinds of ideologically based connections with your brand.
And bad news has always traveled faster than good news, and it must be traveling blisteringly fast in the age of social media, it seems to me. Are these consumer boycotts, Dr. Glickman, they started here, but are they still a particularly American phenomenon, or would you find these going on around the world, particularly when they're connected to some sort of political ideology?
They've become global. I think one of the key boycotts of modern times was the boycott of South African goods when that country was practicing, you know, these racist apartheid policies. And, you know, there was really a massive global economic campaign against that country, which I think ultimately was one of the things contributed to bringing down the apartheid government. So it has become international. I still think Americans, what surveys I've seen show is that Americans turn to boycotts more than any other country. So I still think it's distinctly American, but not exclusive.
Is that because we live in a consumer economy?
I think that's part of it. And I do think that we have, you know, as I said, from the beginning, have connected commerce with politics. And also, as Americus was saying, it's, you know, it's kind of a two-edged sword. It's partly about a statement of identity. And it's partly about where we want our consumer dollars to, what we want our consumer dollars to support.
Companies that put like issues like climate change in their television commercials or Black Lives Matter in their television commercials are stepping out in the forefront of this. They're making it a very public stance about their positions. But companies have always done this, at least behind the scenes, haven't they? They through their lobbying efforts, making contributions to candidates, to political parties, to political action committees. All of that's done, is it not, to shape politics and political policymaking in the favor of the company.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I mean, that's what's interesting about what you're saying, though, Mike, is that, you know, it before it was kind of like kind of a given as part of like the business strategy to be able to create an advantage for the company in terms of how it perhaps would want to grow by being able to affect certain political influences that could help the company do that. But I think what's interesting now is that now it becomes like literally part of the billboard, if you will, the figurative billboard of the brand, which is a very different kind of a thing now, because, you know, I think consumers will now look at this and it would, like you said earlier on, it's going to help them make decisions about which companies they want to try to support and which ones they don't. So the information is now much more transparent, and that makes it more available to be a part of the decision-making process for any individual consumer.
Well, consumers vote with their pocketbooks, with their dollars. And if they don't like what you're doing for many different reasons, including your political support of certain issues, they will not spend their money on your product. That's the only tool we have in the toolkit, it seems to me. But corporations, who are now people, according to the Supreme Court, have a lot more tools than we have. And one of them are these lobbying efforts and donations, major donations to candidates and political action committee. Does that make their... Is that kind of their boycott, a corporate boycott to make these donations and to lobby Congress for certain things? Is that the equivalent, do you think? I'm not sure who to ask that question of.
Well, I'll just step in and say one of the interesting things that I was reading about in regard to the NFL, for example, is that, you know, I think six NFL owners gave more than $1 million to Trump's inaugural committee. And you know, the NFL ownership, you know, has been quite conservative traditionally, but is now sort of turning on a dime, you know, now supporting Black Lives Matter and so forth. And so a lot of people are kind of looking at that and saying, you know, your current statements seem at odds with the recent history. And so, you know, I think it does have to appear consistent to people.
Goya Foods, prior to this kerfuffle, had been doing a lot of things in their own community, helping Hispanic people go to school with scholarships and things like that. And it could be said, I suppose, that he was praising the president because he was trying to get the president to do even more in that area. But there was a backlash. So is this an example, perhaps, of liberal intolerance that conservatives often point to? And I have 15 seconds. Dr. Reed.
Oh, I think the answer is yes. I think identity politics are ruling the day right now, and it's going to continue to be something that's powerful, a kind of very strong in-group versus out-group mentality, unfortunately, because we're living in a divisive place right now. But hopefully, you know, we'll be able to come out of this at some point.
Dr. Americus Reed is a professor of marketing at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. Larry Glickman, Lawrence Glickman, Dr. Glickman, professor of history and American studies at Cornell University and author of Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in America. Thank you both for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.